If you feel like you're, if what's happening in the present moment is you're judging your breath, you bring your mindfulness to the judging. Oh, there's judging of the breath. There's my old friend. And you could even count how many times you do it. And when you get to 392, you'll be a little bit lighter about it.
I do that, but I want to correct it.
You want to correct? So then you want to... So then
you want the,
okay.
No, not correct the judging.
Oh.
Well, I want to correct both.
Yeah. So you're sitting there minding your own business, watching your breath, and then suddenly you notice the breath is not long enough or deep enough. So you judge it. So then you bring mindfulness. Oh, this is judging mind. And you do that, and maybe it dissipates. Maybe it doesn't. And then it's judging. Then you start controlling. You want to control your breath, and you force yourself to breathe deeper. And then you notice you're judging, and so you try to push away the judging and have other kinds of thoughts. At that point, if that's what's happening, that's what's presented itself in the present moment, then you become aware of what it's like to be a person who's controlling their breath or controlling their judging. Isn't that simple? You don't have to get rid of anything. You just have to be really aware of what's happening. And then you might feel, on top of that, that you hate the fact that you're controlling your breath. So you might think, because it's spiritual, not spiritual, to hate your anything. So I'm not going to pay any attention to that. But everything is a field of practice. And you don't push anything away, but you allow yourself to become aware. And in allowing yourself to become aware, at some point you find a spaciousness around whatever it is. Acceptance.
What about the feeling of frustration of not doing something right?
Great. So that's the fourth level, right? And then you maybe pay attention to frustration. This is a very, very important point. There's nothing outside the practice. And if you think there's something outside the practice, then at some point you'll get up and walk away, because you get so frustrated, you think, well, frustration is not the practice, so I can't do the practice. But the frustration is the practice if you bring awareness to that. Are you disappointed?
unsettled.
So where do you feel it in the body? Where do you feel it in the body right now? Close your eyes. So the unsettled feeling, where do you feel it now? Let's keep your eyes closed. Keep your eyes closed a little bit. And how do you experience it there, in the middle? Huh? So be aware of tightness. You might say to yourself, tightness. And is the tightness going to fill your whole stomach, or is it a small area of the stomach? Uh-huh. Is it more on the surface of your stomach or deep inside?
Uh-huh.
And if it had a shape, what kind of shape is it? Flat, square, round?
Round.
Uh-huh. And is it, does it have sharp edges or weak edges or kind of diffuse edges?
Uh-huh.
And in that round area of tension, is there some place that's particularly strong?
Center.
So bring your awareness to the center of that area and notice as tension. And be aware of what happens to it as you're aware of it. Does it get stronger or weaker or stay the same?
Get weaker.
So continue being aware of it, seeing what happens. Sensing what happens. And what's happening to it now?
I feel like I'm relaxing into it.
So, and what's your state now, your emotional state? Do you still feel unsettled, or?
No, I'm more acceptable. You have a very soothing voice, too.
Sometimes I think I should sound like a drill sergeant. I'd be a much more effective meditation teacher, because people wouldn't be relying on a voice. You're not supposed to rely on anything outside of yourself. But that's the process you need to do for yourself. And things change pretty quickly if you bring yourself into the experience. So there's nothing outside. And so wherever you find yourself, whether it's in the fourth, fifth, 15th generation of reactivity, go into that and note it fully and feel it in the body. And a lot of people get restless, especially beginners. And you see people fidgeting and moving. And they don't have the idea that restlessness itself, the feeling, sensations of restlessness or being unsettled, are the very stuff that we pay attention to at times in meditation. And you go into that and you find there's a way that if you bring very attentive to it, you find it some way that it's manageable to be with it.
I was so tired and restless, I felt like I was dying.
Uh-huh.
And I can't imagine getting past that. It was agony.
Well, it's possible.
That's what everybody said, but I just don't.
But it's also wise sometimes to take a break. And being a beginner and your first one day sitting, maybe you should, put a left or gone for a walk and come back. And
I did okay for a while, got to one up tower, and I've gone this far, and
take it easy. The point of as I keep saying in this meditation practice, is to find some way to be present for what is happening. And finding that ability is more important than not feeling frustrated or feeling calm. So in the midst of your frustration, can you find some way to allow that to be without getting worked up even more? Can you establish some kind of peaceful relationship with even being frustrated? And it's possible. So it could be that the real cutting edge of your practice is not the early part of the day where you're calm and everything's going well or whatever, but really that's the place of least acceptance is at the last hour. And that's you're up against your cutting edge. So it's fascinating to work that area. But you don't want to work that area to the degree that you get discouraged. And if that's what's happening, you should take a break. Get up and go for a walk or stretch your legs or whatever it takes.
And another about what we're taking away from paying attention to my breath while we were sitting is the birds. Is that I like listening to them.
Huh?
And then I think, well, they're here in the moment.
Yeah. Well, sometimes I said, what takes you away from the present, right? So what takes you away from the present was maybe the more the key question. Sometimes there are... Well, let me say a little bit here. There are five things, five states, mental, emotional states, which are singled out in the Buddhist tradition as being those things which are particularly powerful in pulling us away from the present moment, pulling us away from the present. They somehow grab or hold on to, it's kind of like, I call them black holes of awareness. A black hole in the sky are these stars that have such strong gravitational pulls that whatever light travels near them or into them doesn't leave, because the gravity pulls the light to the surface of the body. So it's dark, it's a black hole. These black holes of the mind are states of the mind which are so strong that awareness gets sucked up into them and no awareness comes out, so you can't see them. And these are very powerful states which prevent people from entering into the present moment. And so these are things that are very common, very standard things. There's other things also, but these are particularly strong. That when these five things have been fully kind of acknowledged and recognized and become familiar in meditation, the meditation will become a lot easier. So it's important to mention these five. And these things are strong desire, craving, lust, attachment, wanting things to be different, wanting to have a better meditation experience and wanting it so badly, or wanting to have a better spouse, or wanting to have a better whatever, or a better car, or a better house, or better wanting things. So it's wanting, and you're lost in fantasy. People sometimes spend days in the meditation in sexual fantasies, strong desires that might arise. And which are so powerful, they pull you away from the present, you get lost in them. So if one is strong desires. The second is strong aversions, ill will, hate. And sometimes people spend, you know, hate, you get consumed by ill will towards someone or yourself, or anger or aversion. And you get lost in the story or lost in the emotion, and it keeps you from the present moment. And sometimes just in meditation is you hate your experience you're having right now. You wish you had a better one. And so you really hate it, and so you have this whole story about how terrible it is. And the third is what's called sloth and torpor. Sleepiness, but not just sleepiness, because you can be naturally sleepy, but it can be cloudiness of the mind, drained energy, dullness of the mind. The mind feels very dull, very tired, very heavy. The body feels very heavy. And it's very difficult. You might keep almost falling asleep or falling over. And in states of sloth and torpor, it's very hard to meditate. You get pulled into those states. The fourth is restlessness and anxiety, or restlessness and worry. When you're very restless or worrying a lot or very anxious, it's also very hard to be present. And they'll pull you away from the present over and over again. And the fifth, and what's said to be the strongest of these five, these five are called the five hindrances in Buddhism. And the strongest of the five is doubt. Because doubt is what can... doubt is most likely the one to pull you away from practicing or get you to give up. And doubt involves doubting the practice, doubting whether the practice is a good practice. You know, this can't be a good practice. I doubt it. This is not going to help me for anything. Doubting the teacher. That teacher doesn't know anything. Who does he think he is? You know, he's, maybe if I found a better teacher, it would be a lot better. And, you know, just all kind of doubts about oneself. Thinking, I can't do this. This might be a good practice, but I'm not the right person for these practices. And I don't have the ability to sit and be present. And doubt about whether it's the right time of day to meditate, or the right day to meditate, or doubt about whether you're wearing the right clothes for meditation. You know, just whatever the doubts are. And the doubts can be quite strong, and you can get lost and swept up in them. So these are the five black holes of the meditation practice. And these visit everyone. It isn't like it visit only bad people, and you're a bad person because you have it. They visit everyone. And part of the process of meditation is becoming a connoisseur of black holes. Learning to recognize them and saying, oh boy, here it is. I get to really become familiar with it. So you explore it, you get to know it really well. The problem is not desire or aversion or sloth or torpor or these things. The problem is the hindering quality of them, the gravitational pull of these things. You don't have to get rid of these things to do the practice. What you need to do is to overcome the gravitational force that makes it difficult for you to be in the present when they're there. And part of that is the identification and attachments we have around these things. So we might have very strong desires or attachments, or we can have very strong aversions. And either one of those can fuel the gravity of these strong black holes. So one way to overcome this kind of gravity, this identification, is to learn to recognize them very quickly and very early. Can you recognize these things when they arise? And the more familiar you are with them, the less likely you are to be pulled away. So we've talked about, in this course so far, mindfulness of breathing, being aware of the breath, and in a sense, allowing the breath to be the center of the practice, where you rest in your practice. The mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of emotions, and states, moods, and states of mind, mindfulness of thinking and thoughts, and how to work with that. And in a sense, it's just simply being aware of what presents itself to you. And it's very kind of straightforward, it's kind of analytical, in a not thinking way, but just seeing what makes up this experience, sensing it, feeling it, and all that. Another whole part of this meditation practice is not just simply seeing things as they are, but seeing patterns of phenomena, patterns of experience, and seeing how the experiences we have in our life relate to other experiences and relate to other aspects of our experience. The causality. So for example, you might notice that when you have strong anger arises in you. You don't just simply notice the anger, but you might notice that that with anger comes a dulling of your vision. You don't see so well anymore. You don't see other people so well. You see only parts of them. So you see the consequences of being angry. And or you notice that when you don't are angry, you see the person more clearly for who they are fully. And that's interesting to notice, that there's a cause and effect relationship between states of being and how we experience the world. You might notice that there's a relationship between what route you take to work and you drive to work. That if you drive on 101 to work, you get to work in a more irritated mood than if you drive on the Central Expressway or whatever, you know, something that's a more easygoing road to go on. You see that there's a relationship, cause and effect relationship, and you see what that causality is. And the way that decisions, wise decisions can arise for our life from mindfulness practice is becoming aware of what the cause and effect relationship is between what we do. So it's not just simply recognizing that now I'm angry or now I'm tired or now I'm happy or now I'm joyful, but noticing I drove in 101 and that's really difficult for me and I ended up being irritated. So you say, oh, maybe it's useful not to drive on 101 and to choose some other route. So seeing cause and effect relationship. And this is very important in Buddhism, because in Buddhism there's no external authority for making a decision about how you live your life. Buddhism doesn't have a god which says, you know, this is the way it should be. And Buddhism doesn't have a tradition that says, listen to the tradition, this is the way you should live your life. Rather, what Buddhism offers you is the tools to help you notice in yourself what is the cause and effect relationship when you do some things. So you might make some mistakes for a little bit, but after a while you learn. And you say, if I do this, this makes me more open and more compassionate. If I do this, I've learned that it closes me up and makes me less compassionate. So you choose the things that help you become more open and more compassionate. But noticing also the patterns between things. And one of the patterns they talk about is what's called, in a tradition it's called the knots, usually translated into English as the fetters, but the literal Buddhist word is the knots. And this is the place where we get knotted up. There can be, you can see a flower, and you can be aware of seeing. And then we can enter into a relationship based on that seeing. We want the flower, and strong, you know, it's your neighbor's prize rose, and they're going to take it to the fair on Saturday, but you just, you know, you can't stop thinking about how you want that rose, for you have the perfect vase for it, right? So that's a fetter. You've been tied up together with the rose, with the flower. So it isn't simply seeing, but there's also a relationship you form with the seeing. So we become aware of those two things. The relationship that we form with the experience and the experience. We see how those two are different things. It's very interesting. You can do that for all the different senses. You can go, for example, down, I don't know where you go, but you can go down, you know, Stanford Shopping Center and look in the windows and notice when, look at all the windows and notice when you get one of these knots. You know, when you kind of, you know, there's a little bit more than just kind of looking at everything evenly, but when you get caught. And it can be with anything, any of the sense doors, sounds, tastes, touches. Noticing what our relationship is to the experience we're having is a very important area for developing wisdom and compassion and understanding. And I just underlined the word compassion. It's important to be very compassionate to yourself. And if you can't be compassionate to yourself, then be compassionate with your inability to be compassionate. Or at least be forgiving. Or at least accept it. Or if you can't do any of that, just try to be as mindful as you can. Yes?
Curious how you would define compassion.
Well, we define it differently in different situations, I believe. But I think compassion towards oneself, you see your foibles and stuff and your difficulties, is, I guess, maybe another word that's somewhat related, it's not synonymous by any means, is forgiveness, being forgiving. recognizing that there's suffering here, and feeling somehow. When you feel compassion for someone else, you kind of feel, you empathize with their suffering. You feel their suffering in some way. And that feeling someone else is suffering is compassion. In Buddhism, there's often a feeling, there's an added little element to compassion, that not only is the feeling of someone else's compassion, but was hoping that that's feeling someone else is suffering, but hoping that that suffering gets alleviated. So compassion for oneself is to have some kind of sense, oh, I'm suffering, and feel that this is maybe a human condition, and just like you would feel compassion for someone else and want them to feel better, you do it for yourself. But also it's very, you're forgiving to yourself. It's very hard to be a human being, and we're so hard on ourselves. So can we forgive ourselves and allow ourselves? It's also related to the word acceptance. Can you accept yourself as someone has this foible or has this tendency? A softening of the heart around this experience. So you hate yourself. Can you be, so to have compassion to yourself is to have a softening around the heart around this self-hate. Just that. Maybe that's the best definition. It's not getting rid of it, but being softer around it. Well, I'm not going to have a chance to say all the things I want to talk about this evening. But I thought it was nice to have the discussion, the questions and answers. I thought that was rich. And maybe more useful because it came from you directly and your concerns. What I wanted to talk more about was how to integrate the meditation, the mindfulness practice into daily life much more. And that seems like an appropriate thing on the last day. But there's not that much time left. But the longest retreat that I did, mindfulness retreat, was 8 months long. And and it wasn't just from 9 to 4:30. It was from 3 o'clock in the morning until 11 o'clock at night for 8 months. So that's kind of, you know, maybe a little bit extreme, but you know, it's possible. That's, you know, that's one way to do the practice. Yes, silent. It was pretty much silent. The only time I really talked was I had a 15-minute interview with the teacher most days. No, there was a translator.
Did you eat?
Yeah, I ate. Well, that's another story. But in the middle of this experience, I was there for about 4 months or so, and so right in the middle, I was ordained as a traditional monk. So suddenly there was this flurry, a relative flurry of activity. And so I went through the ceremony and then I went back to my room where I was going to continue because I was mostly in my room by myself all this time. And I felt, you know, I felt how frazzled I was and how completely bewildered I was by all this activity, and I talked a little bit. And so I went back to the teacher and said, you know, this mindfulness practice is really great and I'm really enjoying it here, practicing with you. But I realized, you know, when I go back to America and live my normal life, it's a whole different event there. It's a really complicated life and all these things I have to do, and I'm going to have to learn a lot. And what other practices can I do? You know, what can you teach me that's relevant to my daily life? And he kind of looked at me, kind of, in some way, he was a very stern teacher, and so he looked at me really sternly, glaringly. And he said, all you need is mindfulness. That's all you need. Mindfulness. That's all it is. And that I had in my own mind made this idea that mindfulness was something only for this intensive meditation practice and nothing to do with my daily life. And I think he was kind of disappointed in me because mindfulness is about our whole life. And as someone said, maybe Thomas Merton, a spiritual life is first of all a life. It's about how you live your life and how you bring awareness and sensitivity into all aspects of what we do. And I think that to some degree, if you sit and practice every day, you do formal meditation practice every day, the spirit of mindfulness and awareness will begin penetrating into your rest of your activities. And the stronger your meditation practice becomes, the more you have this diffusion into the rest of your life. And so I encourage you to sit every day. Sitting every day is very, very powerful. It's one of the best ways, actually, I feel, to integrate the practice into our whole life. Some people tend to go on... there are maybe, you know, three kinds of students. This is one way of categorizing students. One is a kind of student who only goes on intensive retreats and doesn't do any kind of daily sitting. In between retreats, they just kind of party or whatever they do. Or get depressed, more likely. And they go on an intensive retreat, and they maybe have some very important experiences there. It's very useful for them. And for some people, that's what works best, is just to go on retreats. And for some people, they do that, and not really what works for them. But that's one possibility. The other possibility is to meditate every day at home on a regular basis. And that seems to work very well for a lot of people. And some people, like Kamala, who came a few weeks ago, she didn't go on retreats for a long time. In my experience, in my almost 20 years now of regular meditation and knowing a lot of other meditators, probably the most significant and most powerful effect that meditation or mindfulness practice will have in your life is through having a daily sitting practice for most people, for the majority of people. It's kind of like if you go on retreat. I used to live in Hawaii, and in Hawaii, when I first got there, we had these torrential downpours. And when the first couple of ones, I ran for cover, because that's what you do when it rains. And after a while, I realized you didn't have to, because it would rain for a minute or two, these huge downpours, and then the sun would come out, and your t-shirt would dry. So no problem. The t-shirt, you know, it would dry really quickly. I've also lived in places where there's been a lot of fog, and if you walk through the whole city, from one end to the other, you don't even notice that the fog is getting you wet. It's kind of slowly soaking your clothes. And by the time you finally get to your destination, you're completely soaked through. And it's going to take a long time to dry out. Going on an intensive retreat is kind of like going into a tropical downpour. And it's temporary, and you dry out quickly. It's useful, but you kind of come back into normal situation pretty quickly. Sitting every day, it's kind of like going through the fog and don't even notice that you're getting wet. Many times we don't even know that, we don't even recognize anything's happening. If you measure your meditation by what happens in one day or one week or one month, it's not so useful. You should measure your meditation by, you shouldn't even begin measuring your meditation, the usefulness, for the first 6 months of doing it. Just do it for 6 months or a year or something. But slowly. And you might feel there's immediate benefits. But you probably, if you do it for a couple of years, you look back and say, oh, what I thought was the benefits initially, that wasn't really what was important. It was something else that was slowly developing and building. It's kind of like the changes and the insights and the growth is incremental. When they're so incremental, you don't see it, but it's stable. If you go on retreat and you have an intense experience, it's not so stable. The best combination for almost everyone is to do both. Is to do daily sitting practice and then occasionally have an experience of going on retreat. Retreat's very useful and really helps daily sitting practice. And the deepening that happens, even though it's temporary, is very useful also. So one of the ways in which you can just deepen your mindfulness practice and have it diffuse into your rest of your life is to do more formal sitting, whether every day or on retreats. And we do one-day sittings here in Palo Alto pretty regularly and weekend sittings and there's longer sittings. You can go for week-long sittings and 10-day sittings and 6-week sittings. And it might be a relief for you to know that the longest retreat you can have in America right now is 3 months. but there's also all kinds of things you can do for cultivating the practice in daily life. And I don't mean to be trite or simplistic or something, but... the best way to think about it is that there's not a technique for doing that. It's just you start paying attention. Pay attention to what you're doing. It's not a technique, it's just paying attention. Is paying attention a technique? Start paying attention. How you do it, you pay attention. You can ask yourself, what's happening? But you do it, and it becomes you do it, and you do it, and you do it, and it starts becoming muscle that gets stronger and stronger, and you find yourself living in the present more, noticing much more what's happening in the present with your thoughts, your feelings, your emotions, the situation around you. However, having said that, I think what's important to have said, there are all kinds of ways to help deepen and develop mindfulness through your life. One way is simplify your life. If you do 10 things at once, chances are you're not going to be very mindful of any of them. If you do one thing at a time, there's easier to be really mindful of what's going on there. So simplify your life. Do less. You might find if you do less, you'd be happier and you can be more present. And you might find that being more present will bring more happiness. And it's kind of, the happiness of awareness is kind of elusive because you don't see awareness so much. You can't see mindfulness. You can see, you know, whether you have, you can see whether, you know, I don't know what, that you have more material goods, or you can see whether you've kind of done 10 things that day and done all these different things. But mindfulness is kind of invisible. But with developing a mindfulness comes something that's much more valuable than all the kind of doings that we can do. So simplify is a very useful way. Doing one thing at a time is very useful. One thing that's very useful in terms of developing mindfulness in the rest of our life is to choose certain activities that are maybe 5 or 10 minutes long and say, these activities I'm going to be mindful of. If you decide you're going to be mindful all the time, you're going to get frustrated, it's not going to work so well. But if you say, well, for 5 minutes I'm going to be mindful. These 5 minutes I wash the dishes, I'm going to be mindful. I'm going to turn off the radio and not talk to anybody. I'm just going to be with the dishes. Or the 10 minutes that I take a shower. Choose something you do that takes 10 or 15 minutes. And it's very nice to do something which is repetitive, you do every day on a regular basis. So you're developing some familiarity with it. And as you develop familiarity, your mindfulness can get stronger and stronger, and you can understand yourself and relationship that better and better. So you might for 1 week decide to do the dishes. And the next week you might decide to do every time you fold the laundry. And that's going to be your mindfulness practice, folding the laundry. And the next week it's going to be when you make and eat breakfast. Imagine eating breakfast without reading the paper for a week. And slowly you begin getting a sense of what it's like, getting a feeling of what it's like to be mindful. And it begins permeating your life much more. Another thing which is very useful is associating yourself with other people who do mindfulness practice or do spiritual practice. It's very hard to do almost any spiritual practice alone. And it's certainly hard to do mindfulness practice alone. And it's very hard if you've been doing mindfulness practice and you have developed, you're feeling a sense of deeper integrity from the mindfulness meditation, and you want to try to express or cultivate that integrity in the rest of your life, it's very useful to be associated with people who are doing the same thing. So hanging out with people, it's very useful to come and sit at a sitting group. Come to a weekly meditation group. And there are a number of them around. You can come and sit with us. We'll be sitting Thursdays on a regular basis. You can come sit with us on Mondays. There are other sitting groups around. On Wednesday evenings, you can sit with the Zen people in Mountain View. And you can look around and you'll find groups to sit with. It's also very useful from time to time to discuss your practice and your questions with a teacher. And one of the best places to do that is to go on one-day sittings where teachers are usually available to answer some questions. I'm the local teacher, so come to these Thursday or Monday sittings and ask me questions before or after, or if I ask for questions, you can ask questions. Or you go on other retreats. The collective of teachers that I'm part of, we teach retreats all over in Spirit Rock, up in Marin, and different places in Santa Cruz. And go check out other teachers and get their perspective and ask questions from them. Some people have cues they use throughout their daily life to encourage them to pay attention. And one cue that I like is going through door frames. Because when you go through a door frame, you're going into a new place. Every new room or new place or something. And so things have changed. So it's a good time to pay attention. So whenever I go, I don't always do it regularly as a practice, but there was a period of time where whenever I went through a door frame, that was a cue, kind of stop mentally and bring my awareness into the present moment. What's happening? Some people do it when the phone rings. And the phone rings and they don't answer the phone right away. And they let it ring two or three times or four times or whatever. And maybe even hold the phone or just sit there with the phone and be with your breathing. Just to be with your breathing, two or three cycles of the breath can be very soothing, very settling. And it's kind of a pleasure in the midst of a busy life. It seems like a simple and generous, simple kind of pleasure to give yourself two cycles of breath. So you can choose different cues. If you live or work near the train, every time the train goes by, that's the time to pay attention. Follow your breath a little bit. There was a story of Ram Dass having a meditation group in New York City on top of a fire station. And every once in a while there'd be a fire. And the sirens would go off and the building would kind of explode sounds and the engines would turn on and the building would shake. And at first all the meditators said, this is terrible, distraction in the practice and all that. And then Ram Dass said something like, no, rather than thinking of a distraction, think of it as something that you can use in your meditation practice. This is a Hindu practice where they're trying to raise the kundalini. So he said, you can imagine your kundalini is being awoken. Your energy, inner energy. And so after a while they really got into it. And they couldn't wait until there was a fire in New York City. So anyway, any point, you can use anything. There's nothing outside the mindfulness practice. Everything is mindful. Everything's fuel for mindfulness practice. Could we have turn on the light, please? One of the middle ones. Okay, there, that's good. I think that's the right one. No? Oh, that's too much. Yeah. What have some of you guys learned about integrating the practice in daily life? Some of you might have some experience or some thoughts about it. What do you find useful in bringing awareness into your life? Yes?
Walking. Tamir talked about just being aware when I'm walking anywhere.
Uh-huh.
And so not all the time, but just at moments, I'll just remember I'm walking.
Uh-huh. So walking has become your cue, kind of, to pay you. And we walk a lot, so it's beautiful. Yes?
There's so many options. that's what I'm starting to feel. Before, I just do things a certain way.
Uh-huh.
But now I stop and think.
And
there's so many options.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of fun to just sit there and think about it and be able to choose and not just go and...
Automatically, yeah. Mm-hmm. In some ways, life becomes richer. Because if you slow down and be aware for a moment before acting, you realize the present is pregnant with possibilities. And those possibilities are available to you then. Yeah?
I think also develop being like a witness. All of a sudden, if I was really into it, anger or whatever, I could step back and look at yourself. Look what you're doing. You're working yourself up. It's not that important.
Uh-huh.
And then just let go. It's not easy. And it takes a while, but just developing that witness just seems to come from this.
It reminds me of a quote that I read recently about, and it has to do about self-hate. If you can't love yourself, then at least love the eyes that see your hate.
Mm-hmm. And then you can laugh at yourself.
Yeah.
Then...
Great. Yeah.
When I walk the dogs, I do it twice a day. I would find that there were times before I was doing this, I was very present. I think it's because I do it every And then I can remind myself to say, just walk the dog. And then I can stay at the park and look at the dog instead of thinking about what I'm going to do when I get home.
And what's the difference? So, by the end of your walk, the time you get home, how is your state of being different according to those two options?
It's really different when I can really stay there.
Uh-huh.
It makes the time seem much longer and fuller, and I feel more relaxed and more efficient.
More what?
Efficient.
Efficient, anyway. That's a great lesson. Do less so you can do more.
But you can't want to do it.
Yeah.
So you can do it.
What? I have a practice that whenever I feel harried and I have a lot of things to do and I can't do it all, I'm rushing around, I'll stop. Just stop. Just don't do anything for a while. And then start again. And it seems like, in the moment, it just seems like it's impossible to stop, you know. But it's just, of course you can stop. The world's not going to fall apart. When I worked in a monastery in the kitchen, and serve for lunch was always very hectic because in a Zen monastery, the food has to be served up exactly at 12 noon on the second. Because, Zen monasteries are kind of anal about the schedule. Well, it's all choreographed. It's like a dance. The whole Zen monastery, that wasn't fair to say, but exactly. But it's more like the whole Zen monastery is like a dance. And a choreographed dance, the timing is very important, right? So the kitchen activity is part of the choreography, part of the dance. So if you're not there at the right time to catch your partners flying through the air, there's consequences, right? So there's 40 people up in the meditation hall doing all this dance with their food and their bowls and everything, and they expect the food to show up at that particular moment. So the pressure, have the food ready was, and it was always a great flurry. But every day, 5 minutes before serve up, we had to stop and chant for a minute. The whole kitchen had to stop what they're doing, get in front of the altar and chant. And I couldn't believe it. it was a struggle, And then for a while, I was a kitchen manager, and I was more responsible than anybody. And it was a temptation to say, let's forget it today. It was so strong. And for some reason, there was always time to take that minute. It was never a problem. To stop. Stop and look around. And I realized that one of the things I should have done in this introductory course is talked about mindfulness, walking meditation. And I didn't. What I'll do is, next week, we're not having our regular meetings here. However, some of the Quakers have invited a meditation teacher from Oregon who is leading a retreat, I think, next weekend to come and use this. They want to use the place during our times, and they want to kind of harmonize with us, so they're doing it the same time as we are, and they want to have not the very long meditation, but short meditation. And I talked to this teacher, and he pulls, apparently, many different spiritual practices from many different spiritual teachings. He's not just a mindfulness teacher, but he knows something about Vipassana. I was going to give a talk, he said, that's very compatible with or could be considered a mindfulness talk. So I don't know him, so I can't exactly recommend him, but he seems like a very nice man on the phone. And so it might be very nice for you to come and see. And they're going to run it pretty much the way we usually do it. And and then we'll continue our regular Thursdays the week after that. And what that means is that we start at 7 for the regular kind of beginner's night. Start at 7, and someone will give, usually I or someone else, some very short instructions to start the meditation, like for 2 or 3 minutes for new people. And we'll sit for half an hour, and then we'll have 45 minutes of the talk and discussion, and then we'll end with 15 minutes of sitting. And it's very nice, and so we'll do that until we do the next introductory course, which is I think September, October. So, and so what I think I'll do is one of those sessions in June, one of those Thursdays in June, I'll give a talk on walking meditation and instructions, and I can't tell you when, but some of you will be here, some of you won't. And so for any of you who missed the first couple of times when I talked about dana or donations,